Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome our guest co-host today, Dr. Cam Coleman. Welcome, Cam.
Thank you, Adam. It's great to be here.
You know, you're one of our new great trainees in the Preventive Medicine program, and we're really excited that you're here. And I know a number of your colleagues also want to be here, so we're going to welcome them as co-hosts in upcoming shows as well.
I think they're excited to be here, and they're probably going to be listening so that they have a good understanding of what not to say when they're in front of the microphone.
Oh, you know the only rule is there are no rules.
All right. That's my kind of rule.
Well, we're going to have a rule today that we are going to have a great guest, and it's a cardiologist and director of the heart failure program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Dr. Sandeep Jahar, about a new book he's written called Heart, A History. But first, we have some great research that matters. Let's dive right into our very first one about fried food and the risk of early death. And let's just say it right off the top. I do like French fries.
I do too, and I like fried chicken, and I like a lot of other fried foods. I grew up in southeastern Virginia, so this was sort of a staple where we grew up. But of course, we know that fried food can't be good for you, and we know we're probably not supposed to eat it all the time. So what did this study tell us?
Well, so this was an article that was actually in what's called BMJ, the British Medical Journal, and they were really interested in trying to see, is there a relationship between eating fried food or the types of fried food, the amount of fried food, and actually cardiovascular disease, just like we're going to be talking about with our guest in a little bit, and to see heart deaths, but also cancer-related deaths. And this is data that comes from the Women's Health Initiative, probably one of the largest studies, if not the largest study in the world, of over 100,000 women between 1993 and ultimately followed up through February of 2017.
Yeah, this is a lot of people that they looked at. And we should emphasize that these were women aged 50 to 79, an age group that we don't always associate with higher risks of heart disease. But again, this study looked at women only. And what did they find?
So they were looking at the types of fried things that people might eat, like chicken or fish sandwich, shrimp, oysters that are fried, French fries, tortilla chips, and tacos. I don't really thought about that tortilla chips are frequently fried.
And all the good stuff, basically.
All the good stuff. And let's just go right into it. If you ate one or more servings a day, you had an 8% higher risk compared to those who didn't eat fried food. That doesn't sound too bad. But what about if you ate fried chicken? Well, how much was your risk increased?
Yeah, so they found that one or more servings of fried chicken each day was linked to a 13% higher risk of death from any cause and a 12% higher risk of death from heart disease.
And even if you ate fried fish, we know fish isn't generally good for you, but the fried fish had a 7% higher risk of any death from any cause and a 13% higher risk of heart-related death. There was no relationship between fried food and the cancer. And this was particularly pronounced really in these women who were younger, who were non-white, and had lower levels of income and education. So there's a health disparity here, which makes it even worse. There's some take-home messages here about really what we need to be talking about with patients in the encounter room.
Yeah, more opportunities for lifestyle modification and discussions about healthy behaviors. You know, I checked and it didn't look like there were any representatives from Kentucky Fried Chicken or Chick-fil-A that were able to comment on this study. So we'll have to reach out to them.
Yeah, I think it'll be a long time coming. The next research that matters is actually about some issues relating to weight gain, but it's actually this time it's tied to employment. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so this was a study out of Sweden, a study of almost 4,000 people that looked at the relationship between stress on the job and changes in weight.
We should back up by saying we know from our own experience in the training of being a physician, it can be stressful.
Certainly.
And sometimes the eating can go two different ways, right? You might say you don't have time to eat,
right,
or you might just say you don't have time to exercise. If you don't have time to exercise, you're probably going to gain weight in that stress. And of course, you didn't have time to eat. You may not gain weight. But in this particular one, they were looking at the men and women who really were looked at their work pace, the pressures they had at work, the time they had for their work, and how many of the demands were kind of contradictory. You got to work harder and faster, but oh, by the way, you don't have as much time. And they followed these men and women 3 times over 20 years.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting. They had almost 4,000 participants in this study, so a pretty hefty group. But the way that they measured stress was essentially asking these people, how do you feel are your job demands? So this was all self-reported data on levels of stress.
And they found that the stress seemed to have this impact on the women that they – The higher it was, the women were actually more likely to gain weight. They didn't see it in men. They didn't have really good reasons for it. I think there's a lot more to the story than just the high stress of work. There's a lot more going on here that I don't think they could tease out.
Yeah, and you know, they speculated that why is it that women might be more sensitive to changes in weight as opposed to men? And one of the things that they mentioned in this article was some of the differences in gender roles that they found in their culture and expectations for women to be spending more time at home. And so that's certainly something that enters into the public conversation often. What should be the norms? What should be the expectations? And to what degree should men and women be really sharing some of this other work if that's contributing to these weight changes?
Our next research that matters has to do with what they call low-risk cancers. I see this a lot in some of my patients. You know, they get diagnosed with sometimes a ductal carcinoma in situ, you know, a type of breast cancer, and like, oh, a type of breast cancer, but it's really kind of benign. Or they get prostate cancer. They say, ah, but it's not a very high score. It's really low risk. We can just do watchful waiting. My patients look at me and go, what?
Yeah, this hits home for me because my mother was just diagnosed with DCIS, or that low-risk form of breast cancer, and she had to have a lumpectomy or part of her tissue removed, and then she had to have 6 weeks of radiation. So what we think of clinically as sort of a low-risk cancer, it can be really scary for patients.
And this was in also the British Medical Journal today, and they were really talking about maybe the nomenclature should change. Maybe we should not call these cancers. And I do know I was recently with a patient of mine who the biopsy report said prostate cancer, but the urologist said, well, the way this is done, it's so low risk, we don't actually call it cancer. And we don't have to do anything other than just kind of watch it. And I thought, well, that was reassuring. So I think things are changing and there's still some debate. We know once people hear they have quote unquote cancer, that really gives them a label that's really hard to go fully back from.
Yeah, and it's really difficult to convey that idea that cancer is just a spectrum. It's not just one disease. I really remember when I was a medical student, we had a professor who stood up in front of the classroom and he said, if I had the choice between having thyroid cancer and diabetes, I'd rather have thyroid cancer 100 times out of 100. And we were first-year medical students, and that really stunned us because we sort of came into class thinking, oh my gosh, cancer, that C word. But I think it's important, and sometimes it can be sort of jarring when somebody reframes a disease that we tend to be really scared of.
A lot of times cancer increasingly is a chronic disease rather than a fatal diagnosis. Let's talk about our last research that matter briefly, and it's about the genetics of obesity, which we're familiar with, particularly through genes, you know, twins and gene studies. But this was actually a little different. This was actually about the genetic of slimness.
Yeah, this is interesting. So this is a study that took place over in the UK where they actually have very similar rates of obesity as we have here in the US. But what they tried to do, these researchers, they tried to look for people who were particularly thin, and they measured thinness by a term that many of our readers and listeners will be familiar with, the BMI, or the body mass index. But they looked for people with a BMI less than 18, and we think of those people as being pretty underweight. So to give you an example, to have a BMI of less than 18, if you're a man and you're 6 feet tall, you weigh 130 pounds. So I think that's more than just being slim. That's pretty thin.
Yeah, and actually the name of this study was the STILT study, the study into lean and thin subjects. I'd actually like to have been a volunteer in that particular study. I don't think I would have qualified. I think my BMI is 25. Do you know your BMI?
I calculated it today, actually. It's 22.8.
I'm aspiring to be like you.
You know, my fiance always gives me such a hard time. She says, you have such a high metabolism, you can eat whatever you want. And she'll sometimes catch me in the kitchen if I'm taking a scoop of peanut butter or a scoop of ice cream after the gym. And she'll say, oh, it must be nice. But I sort of grin because I typically try to limit myself to just one scoop.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll be talking with cardiologist and director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Dr. Sanjeev Jahar, about his new book, Heart, A History. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Cam Coleman. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Cam Coleman. Today on Conversations, we have an exciting opportunity to talk with cardiologist and acclaimed director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Dr. Sanjeev Jahar, about his new book, Heart, A History. Welcome, Dr. Jahar.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it's really exciting to have you on. I think anytime we get a cardiologist on our show, it's always exciting. There's always something new and interesting. And here you come along with a book that's just chock full of stories that we're going to spend a lot of time, and I know our listeners want to hear about, but I think we'd like to hear a little bit more about you to start with. How did you get interested in cardiology, and then how did you get interested in also being an acclaimed author?
Well, my interest in the heart stems from my childhood. My paternal grandfather died suddenly of a heart attack many years before I was born. I never met him. But he died in the presence of my father, who was not yet 14 years old. They were having lunch together, and he slumped to the floor and passed away. And, you know, like many who have witnessed the sudden death of a loved one, my dad never really got over it. There was a sort of grief that really suffused his whole life, you know, his adulthood. And by extension, in my childhood, there was a tremendous reverence and really fear of heart disease, and that really entered all facets of our home. I remember my mother would say, "Better do your chores, or your dad's going to get heart failure," and that really affected us.
That's a big guilt trip right there.
Yeah, that's a major guilt trip. She didn't mean anything by it, you know. She was a lovely mom and woman, but it was just that sort of thing. And you know, the reason why the fear was there, and I think the fear is there for many, perhaps you know your listeners, about the heart, and frankly of doctors in general, is that the heart is the only organ that can kill you suddenly. You know, no other organ can do that, and so, you know, really within a matter of seconds, you can be, you know, seemingly healthy, you know, vibrant, going about your daily life like my grandfather was, and all of a sudden be felled by this sudden event. And so, you know, I was just fascinated by the heart as this entity that, on the one hand, is so strong, so powerful. I mean, a human heart beats 3 billion times in a typical human lifetime. And it's so powerful, it consumes so much energy, that if you hook up a typical adult heart to a swimming pool, it would empty the swimming pool within a week.
That's so interesting, and I think our readers sometimes forget about the function of the heart and the role that it plays in our day-to-day life. But tell us more about what other vital purposes the heart serves for us.
The heart is really an amazing organ. I mean, the heart pumps blood and oxygen to every organ. So when the heart stops, life stops. That's really pretty clear. In fact, the heart doesn't rely on any other organ to function, yet every other organ relies on the heart. The heart doesn't just pump blood to the rest of the body, it pumps blood to itself, which is, you know, really pretty amazing, really mind-bending when you think about it.
So we're talking about an organ for which you clearly have respect, fascination, sometimes fear, and it it influences you not only to go into a profession based on your own family, but it influences you to want to dive deeper into the history, which is not a topic that people would sometimes go, wow, what were you surprised about as you wrote about this book and the history of the heart?
Yeah. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. My fascination with the heart really started with my family, was extended by just the fact that the heart is just the most amazing machine probably, you know, that nature has ever invented. But it really deepened as I learned more about the history of heart discovery. And that history is absolutely fascinating. In some ways, starts in the late 19th century. So most people don't realize that before the late 19th century, about 1880s and 90s, the heart had never been operated on. Every other organ in the body had been operated on, but not the heart, including the brain. So why is that? Well, there are a couple of obvious things. One is that the heart is always moving. So, you know, it's very hard to surgically manipulate something that's constantly moving. The heart's also filled with blood. So to try to fix something inside the heart means you have to cut it open, and then, you know, a patient would bleed to death. So if you divert blood away from the heart, sort of empty it of blood, so you can cut it open and fix it, then there's nothing circulating blood, and you would develop brain damage. So there are just tremendous obstacles to manipulating the heart.
And you talk about the very first heart catheterization being kind of a self-experiment.
Yeah. So as I delved into the history, I learned more about, you know, what scientists and doctors did to overcome some of these obstacles. And a lot of the experiments were done on animals, really on dogs and cats, which is really, as a dog lover, was very disturbing to me. Many of the earliest operations were done on children. And a lot of the early research was done by doctors on themselves. So, for example, Werner Forssmann did the first cardiac catheterization on himself, where he got a nurse to help him get a catheter, a rubber tube, and then he pretended that he was going to be doing this on the nurse, but in fact he tied the nurse to a gurney and then slit open his own vein in his arm and inserted the catheter and pushed it up into his heart, and then had the nurse walk him down to the X-ray suite to take a picture. So,
scary.
These kinds of advances were really miraculous, and so many of them were done as self-experiments. And that was another fascinating aspect of the history that I really wanted to present to readers.
I saw a lot of interesting procedures in the heart catheter lab when I was a medical student, but I could not imagine seeing a cardiologist cath himself. I think that would have been really something.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned another story about some of the cardiovascular history of U.S. presidents. I'm wondering if you could tell us more about some of the stories that stick out from your research.
Yeah, well, I mean, one is FDR. You know, FDR had malignant hypertension. But back in his day, doctors didn't realize that blood pressure directly, you know, damaged the heart. In fact, many doctors thought that it was okay for elderly people to have blood pressures that were in the, you know, let's say systolic blood pressure was 170 or so. FDR's blood pressure was much higher. In fact, by the time of the Yalta conference in 1945, his blood pressure regularly exceeded 200. And, you know, he eventually died of a brain hemorrhage. But what really came out of that was that you know, after a beloved president like FDR had died he had heart failure, he eventually succumbed to a brain hemorrhage, but it was all because of vascular disease and hypertension. The Framingham Heart Study was initiated through the newly formed National Heart Institute, and this all came about because of FDR's death. And the Framingham Heart Study, of course, led to our modern understanding of the usual risk factors like diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, and so on for heart disease. One thing the Framingham did not do is properly investigate the emotional causes or risk factors associated with heart disease. And that's something that I delve into very deeply in the book.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, let's pick up on this, what we might call high-tech and high-touch visiting with heart. We're going to continue talking with cardiologist and director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Dr. Sandeep Jahar, about his new book, Heart, A History. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Cam Coleman. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with cardiologist and director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Dr. Sandeep Jahar, about his new book, Heart, A History. And right before the break, Dr. Jahar, you were mentioning this technology and the history, and that sometimes it's easy to substitute the technology for the emotional aspects and how those interplay. And it reminded me of a cousin of mine, a beloved Dr. Mark Silverman, who was a cardiologist at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, who right in the really prime of his career died suddenly at his desk. Here, a cardiologist dying of a heart attack. And yes, the tragedy of the physical aspect was great, but the emotional aspect for the family, for the patients, for the community were even greater.
Yeah. You know, one of the themes of the book is exploring this intersection between the emotional or metaphorical heart and the biological heart. Now, in a modern day, we think of the heart as a biomechanical pump, and it is an amazing pump. But back in antiquity, you know, really up through the Middle Ages, until William Harvey actually figured out that the heart circulates blood through the body, the heart was thought of as really an emotional organ. It was thought of as the seat of the soul or the storehouse of emotions like courage, love. And I was fascinated by, you know, is there a connection between the metaphorical heart and the biological heart? And in fact, in my research, I found that there is a pretty strong connection that, you know, emotional stress, whether it's acute or chronic, can drastically affect the heart. Acute emotional stress can lead to what we colloquially refer to as broken heart syndrome. In medicine, we call it Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, but it's an acute weakening of the heart in response typically to emotional stress from the death of a loved one or the breakup of a romantic relationship. We also know that chronic stress, because of, you know, workplace problems, difficulties in a relationship, that can also accelerate the process of coronary disease. So the emotional heart and the biological heart are really linked, and I really do a deep dive into that in the book.
It's so interesting because we're all familiar with the normal pieces of advice that we're told, these things you can do to take care of your heart, eat right, exercise regularly. But we forget about things like loneliness. And in fact, the Surgeon General has recently come out saying that loneliness can be a risk factor for heart disease. What can you tell us about that, and what advice do you give your patients?
Yeah, so many of us intuitively believe that emotional stress drastically affects our hearts. But the American Heart Association still doesn't list emotional stress as a key modifiable risk factor for heart disease. One of the reasons for that is that the Framingham Heart Study that we talked about that came after Roosevelt's death really focused on biological risk factors, sort of objective factors like serum cholesterol or number of packs of cigarettes smoked per week or, you know, things like that, stuff that was easily measurable. It was very hard to properly take into account emotional, you know, risk factors. And so the Framingham investigators largely ignored them. They largely ignored the psychosocial domain. And I think that set the field back. So, you know, it's pretty clear that you have to take these things into consideration if you want to lead a heart-healthy life. So you're absolutely right. You know, the first step I tell my patients is, you know, eat right, exercise, don't smoke, control your blood sugar. These are all things that all doctors say. But I think also you have to pay attention to the psychosocial domain. You know, work at your relationships. You know, spend time with people who make you feel good about yourself. Try to avoid people who make you feel terrible. These sources of stress can have a tremendous impact on the heart. There's no easy solution. There's no easy prescription for everyone. You know, I mentioned that the American Heart Association doesn't list emotional stress as a risk factor because it's just so much easier to give a pill to lower cholesterol than it is to lower stress. It's very hard to lower stress. So, and it differs for everyone. So I don't have a one sort of size fits all prescription for patients, but there are ways, well described ways to lower stress. You know, exercise, aerobic exercise is definitely one of them. But, you know, yoga, meditation, engagement with friends, neighbors, your community, these are all, you know, really important things that do affect our hearts.
You know, it sounds like it's speak slowly, take deep breaths, and have lots of compassion, which I hear in your voice. You know, one of the things I see today is the modern cardiology experience where patients can be in and out of the hospital in one day after having had a pretty significant heart attack and having had stents placed. Yeah. And I see all the time that my patients emotionally are lagging way beyond and behind the physical experience. And I wonder if you were to think about the next 20 or even 100 years, what are the two things that maybe come to your mind that if you were to write this book 100 years from now, what would you be saying about today's experience in cardiology and the heart?
Well, I mean, I think we've come to a relatively sophisticated place in terms of technology, and we've had a lot of success. In the last 60 years or so, we've developed coronary angiography, coronary stenting, coronary bypass surgery. The in-hospital mortality from a heart attack used to be 30%. Now it's about 3%. And that's in part due to technology and some other things like you know, campaigns to lower smoking rates and so on. So I think we've come quite far in terms of technology, and we're going to continue to make progress on that front. There's no question. We can now replace heart valves without open heart surgery, for example. You know, and who knows what's going to happen with stem cells in the future. So there's a lot that's potentially going to happen. But I do think that this emotional connection with the heart has been largely ignored. And I think that is an area that's really ripe for investigation, looking into things like basic stress reduction techniques and their impacts on the heart. It's been very hard to conduct these studies. They've been relatively small and uncontrolled, but I think that is a frontier that needs to be explored. So I think in decades, when we write about the heart again, hopefully we'll have come, you know, much further on that front.
Well, we'll stay tuned, and we know that you'll be following it closely. Before we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I mean, just a reminder that, you know, we've come so far, and the book really describes that journey of technological discovery. And it's a fascinating story. It's a story that involves, you know, outlandish experiments where parents were connected up to their children during heart surgery and serving as human heart-lung machines. Doctors self-catheterizing themselves, you know, putting catheters into their hearts. All these things were done, and the history is absolutely fascinating and very important. But I do think that the one message that I hope readers come away is with, you know, from the book is that the emotional heart, it's just so important to recognize. And our pump, that pump that's in our bodies, that's, you know, pumping without fail for 70, 80, 90 years, that pump is, of course, a mechanical one, but it's also an emotional one. And, you know, we really have to treat it well to expect it to continue working for us.
Well, I know my heart is expressing gratitude to you for spending time with your health listeners, spending time to talk about your book. We've been talking with Dr. Samdeep Jauhar. And this is your third book, and we're going to put a link to your other two books, but we'll also put a big link to this book on our website. I know our listeners, it's an easy read, I must say. That's a good thing for folks. It's one that you don't want to put down easily.
Thank you very much.
Well, we want to thank you. We're going to take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Cam Coleman. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Cam, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My brother-in-law was just diagnosed with prostate cancer. He and my sister have a great support system, and they have great doctors. But I want to learn more about what they're going through and what he faces. I wondered if you have any good resources that you recommend to patients who want something a little bit more reliable than Dr. Google.
In general, I like to look at what I would call non-proprietary sources. You know, things that they're not trying to make any money off you for anything. So for that reason, I would tend to not have anything from the pharmaceutical industry sponsored, like patient education. But we use a lot in our own work, something called UpToDate. It, again, is the largest source of continuing education for clinicians really in the world. And it's not supported by industry. It's supported by physician subscription. So they have patient education, extensive information for that. And you can ask your doctor, if they subscribe to that service, to print you out that information. It's a good starting place.
It's a great one. And another really helpful resource that I will often point patients to is a website called cancer.gov. And this is where all of the research from the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute, everything that some of the smartest scientists in America are learning about cancer, they put it on this website, again, cancer.gov, in plain language. So you can search by the type of cancer that you're interested in, prostate cancer in this sense, and then you can get an idea of what our researchers know about it, what are some of the causes and treatment options, and that's a great resource for you to prepare for questions with your doctor, because really no substitute can take the place of conversations with your health professional.
Yeah, I think that's a great resource. And there's also increasingly resources that are, we would call, patient-centered resources. And there's a national government-funded organization called PCORI, P-C-O-R-I, which is really about patient-centered outcomes. And they've got a really good article about treatment preference in patient-centered prostate cancer. So how patients really understand these different outcomes is very complex. And we'll ask our great health science librarians to put up a link to these websites as good starting places. It's a great question, and we want to thank that listener. What's our very next house call, Laura?
My three-year-old has recently been experiencing motion sickness more frequently. I hate to see him feel so bad whenever we're traveling. Do you have any suggestions for how we might get him some relief?
Besides leaving him at home.
Right.
That's not an option, is it?
I don't think that's what the listener wants to hear.
Okay. Sorry about that, because, you know, I was just thinking that, particularly if I'm going on that cruise, you know. I remember a cruise we once went on with my father, took all the five of us, or five children and my mother. And I think four of the kids and my mother were in their cabins with motion sickness at the one time. And my dad and I were the only ones out on deck.
You know, I can remember also going on vacations, in particular our cruise to the Bahamas when I was a young kid, and my poor cousin got so motion sick. And that's the first time I ever remember hearing of this medicine called Benadryl. Everyone said, oh, Will's sick, he's motion sick, he should have some Benadryl. Is that something you would recommend, Adam?
Well, in general, you can do these in the right dose for a three-year-old. You could certainly do an antihistamine. There's a difference between child that's never experienced motion sickness and this child who's experienced motion sickness, and they're going to get it. Now, the problem is that they probably are in a car and they're getting motion sick. Well, one of the things I'd check in before I do any medications would say, you know, is the child doing something while they're driving? You don't want to have the child reading or perhaps looking at their video games while they're driving,
right?
Because that actually could increase their motion sickness. So I think there's some simple tricks that we might do. There are some ginger, a lot of our patients and, like, the, you know, natural things, and there's some ginger products they could look into. trying to prevent this is, but probably you need to talk with your doctor and go see your doctor.
Yeah, and I've heard of some other recommendations. You know, some of the times what triggers this feeling of nausea is signals from the eyes to the brain saying that things are uneasy or things are moving. So you can sort of trick the brain by focusing your eyes on something far away. So looking out at the horizon, if you're in a car, looking at something in the distance and just trying to fix the eyes on a point that's not moving. And that can sometimes soothe the brain and sort of cut off those signals that are causing all that nausea.
I spy a cloud at 12 o'clock.
There you go. That's a great game.
I don't know if the three-year-old would know what 12 o'clock means. But
well.
could be out there looking at I spy and just things
are
way
car,
out there.
A blue car. I spy a plane.
You don't look at that red car. It's going right past you. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I frequently get headaches, and someone recently asked me if I ever have thunderclap headaches. What are those?
Well, this is one of those things that you learn in medicine to fear. We call them thunderclap headaches, and the terminology really is just about a severe headache of sudden onset. People oftentimes describe it as the worst headache they've ever had.
Right. This is sort of a classic question. When we're medical students or residents taking board exams, that's often how they'll describe a scenario. A young person who has no other medical problems comes into your office saying, I have the worst headache of my life. It started 10 minutes ago and I can't stand it.
And so, typically within a minute, it's at its peak intensity. And used to be that was associated with intracranial hemorrhage, bleeding in the brain or a rupture of an aneurysm. People would think this is a medical emergency. And it certainly still could be a medical emergency. Now we know there could be other causes, but all of which could be constriction of blood vessels that should be reversible in almost all circumstances if identified appropriately and quickly. Most times if you had this sort of headache, you probably need to be in to see your doctor and get evaluated.
Yeah, that's not the sort of thing that you should just kind of go pick up a BC powder and say it'll get better. If it's really, truly the worst headache of your life, then you should seek expert help.
Particularly if you are confused or speech is altered or something else that would suggest possible stroke or impending stroke.
But there are lots of different types of headache, and it's really important to sort of be very careful as you're describing these. Do I get these headaches every week after a really bad meeting with my boss? Do I get them on Sundays when I've overslept and haven't had any coffee yet? So there's a lot of things that can cause headaches, and not every headache is a thunderclap headache.
Have you been traveling with me recently? Do you know what's going on in my life?
Not at all. Okay, tell me more.
I thought you were like describing my... No. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I recently went in to see my doctor for x-rays of my ankles and knees. My doctor sent me a report that said everything was okay, but when I asked for a copy of the actual report, there were some really worrisome words on there, like chondrocalcinosis, potentially. Is that what that...
Yeah, you got it right.
Pretty
good.
Close.
Good.
Yeah, give her an A.
Early degenerative changes. This sounds bad. Should I be worried?
This is one of those things that I can certainly relate to both the patient's plight and the doctor's plight here. I mean, a lot of times, you know, my own doctor will say, you know, everything's fine. And then I get like a lab result. I'm like, my cholesterol's elevated a little bit. And I know the doctors are really busy. And sometimes you just don't want to get into a more detailed conversation. And it, you know, it's really okay. You got a little bit of arthritis, even that terminology, a little bit. But in this case, I think the patient's probably more right because the doctor probably did the x-rays probably because the patient was having some pain and it may be related to some arthritis.
Yeah, and you know, the people who put those words on that x-ray report, the radiologists, they have to go to school for a long time and learn a lot of sophisticated words in order to get paid. So they have to do something with those words and they put them on the report. But chondrocalcinosis is just the idea that sometimes you can have little calcium deposits along some of the linings of your joints. And we see this often with normal wear and tear that you get after decades and decades of normal activity, especially people who were physically active or involved in sports during their youth.
And you may need a knee replacement.
That could be true. That could be true.
Well, that'll conclude House Calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can share any question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our guest co-host today, Dr. Cam Coleman, and our guest today, Dr. Sandeep Jahar. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Cam Coleman.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.